Welcome to VOA's Campus Connection. I'm David Byrd.
And I'm Lin Young.
Today, we start a two-part series that looks at alcohol use on U.S. college campuses. We'll hear from several experts about what's known as binge drinking, what it is, what it does, and what are some of the consequences.
You know, once they get into this vicious cycle of drinking, and drinking to these kind of extremes, it really has major deleterious social, physical, and interpersonal effects.
We'll also hear from a Nepalese student who had won a full scholarship to a U.S. school, only to have it revoked at the last minute.
We'll visit Columbia University in New York City.
Sports plays a big role in university life in the U.S. How does it compare to other parts of the world?
And we'll also ask students in our local area why they chose the major they did.
That's all coming up on VOA's Campus Connection.
People drink alcohol for a variety of reasons, to celebrate, to commiserate, to socialize, and to relax.
But sometimes alcohol use goes beyond an occasional drink to something worse, alcohol abuse.
Since 1984, the national minimum drinking age here in the United States has been 21 years old, but state laws vary on specifics about possession and exceptions to the federal law, such as allowing people under 21 to drink with their parents.
Drinking at college has almost become a rite of passage in many U.S. schools, but so-called binge drinking can have serious, sometimes deadly consequences.
I spoke to Dr. George Koob. He's the director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. He told me that while the amount of so-called binge drinking has decreased, what's known as extreme binge drinking has emerged.
A binge drink was defined by us and IAAA some 20 years ago as basically reaching a level of 0.08 gram percent, which is equivalent to 4 drinks in 2 hours for a female and 5 drinks in 2 hours for a male on average. Extreme binge drinking can be 2 to 3 times that amount, where individuals actually seek to drink to blackout, which is where you don't remember what transpired while you were drinking.
Dr. Luis Profeta is an emergency physician at St. Vincent Hospital in Indianapolis, Indiana. He says a particularly potent combination is students mixing anti-anxiety or ADHD drugs with alcohol.
In fact, just recently, the data shows life expectancy in America has actually declined because of the opiate epidemic. We're losing a lot of young people to opiates, but also to benzodiazepine sedative drugs like Xanax and lorazepam, Ativan, Valium, things like that. They're being mixed with alcohol.
And it's not only health consequences that students could face. Excessive alcohol use can lead to things like driving under the influence, sexual assault, and other crimes that you do while you're drinking.
Hafiz Lakhani is the founder of Lakhani Coaching, an organization that helps guide students as they apply for and attend college. The Yale graduate said he remembers one particular student who wanted to apply to business school when he was 27.
And I was curious, you know, you worked until you were 24, but you're 27 now. Do you mind just filling me in on what you've done since? He was in a state penitentiary for accidentally killing someone in a DUI accident. That is a serious, serious repercussion. 3 years in prison and having to, and not only the emotional baggage and guilt, he's having to live with the legacy of that mistake for the rest of his life. First of all, just on a personal level. And second of all, professionally. What I'll tell you is a young person needs to think about when you get behind the wheel or when you take certain risks. These aren't just one-night risks. These can stick around forever.
Alcohol use also plays a big role in acquaintance or date rape and sexual assault on college campuses.
Nikki Nance is a licensed psychotherapist and an associate professor of human services and psychology at Beacon College in Leesburg, Florida. She says alcohol use can contribute to assault and that can have lifelong consequences.
My background is mental health counseling. And as a therapist, I've worked with women who had been raped in college. And, you know, when they were in their 40s and 50s, that was still something that came back to them, that changed how they moved about life, that changed how they raised their kids. You know, so, except far-reaching. The effects are far-reaching.
The desire to fit in often plays a big role in whether people choose to use alcohol or not. Lisa Schrader is the director of health promotion at Middle Tennessee State in Murfreesboro, Tennessee.
She says that sometimes students drink because they think it is expected of them, not because they want to.
I think peer pressure is huge, and because we actually have seen that most students are incorrect in what they assume their peers are doing, I feel like a lot of that peer pressure is really a false peer pressure, which makes it even more of a challenge perhaps to address. But we see students across the board who would identify with a belief that when you're in college, alcohol needs to be a part of that experience. In order to have a quote-unquote real college experience, you've got to get drunk on occasion. So whether or not that fits in with their value systems or what they would do in any other environment, they put that pressure on themselves in order to fit in and may choose to take part in riskier behavior than they would otherwise even have an interest in doing.
Dr. George Kube of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism says that international students can be particularly vulnerable to the pressure to drink because they are trying to make friends or not feel isolated.
And that's one of the biggest problems I would imagine for foreign students coming over to the United States is we are social beings, and the biggest, most powerful reinforcer that anybody or reward that everybody feels is being approval from other human beings. And so if the only way you get that approval is by hanging out with a drinking crowd, you know, you're going to be in deep trouble.
In our next program, we'll look at what you can do if you think you might have an alcohol problem or if you know someone who does.
Our experts will offer you advice on what to do if you don't want to indulge or if you are recovering from an alcohol problem. You're listening to VOA's Campus Connection.
Imagine if you decided to study in the United States and you thought you had been accepted with a full scholarship.
You'd probably be delighted, right? Room, board, tuition, housing, all of it paid for. You even have a letter that's welcoming you to the freshman class.
That's what happened to Rushen Podel of Nepal. He was one of the several students who applied to and were accepted by the University of Texas at Tyler.
Rushen told me that when he first learned of the school's opportunities, it was from a Facebook group that he was part of.
In that group, a student from UT Tyler, her name is Eliza Persai. She reached out. She said, if you are interested at UT Tyler, we have some very good scholarship opportunities from this year. They are giving full ride scholarship to students who have SAT scores above 1350. She reached out to me, and that scholarship was very good, and that is why I applied to UT Tyler.
Rushen said that not only did he get a scholarship, he received a letter telling him that he had won the prestigious presidential scholarship.
Congratulations. You have been admitted to the fall 2018 semester at UT Tyler. Welcome to the Patriot family. You have also been awarded our presidential fellowship scholarship, that is our full ride scholarship. More details will follow regarding this scholarship. You should receive a...
Rushen told me by Skype that he was amazed at his good fortune.
As everyone else would be, I was very, very happy. My parents were also very happy. Yeah, for a moment, I couldn't believe I had received such a big scholarship. I had applied a little later than most of my other Nepali students. And even before I got the scholarship, around 40-50 students had already received the scholarship, so I was thinking that I might not get the scholarship because the funds were exhausted. But I got the scholarship, and it is a very good feeling.
But then, after thinking that he was going to attend college at UT Tyler and that he had won a prestigious scholarship, the 18-year-old Rushen received another letter with a much different result.
This letter said that because of what it called extraordinary demand in this year's Fellows program, our scholarship requests exceeded the amount budgeted for this year. As a result, funds for the Presidential Fellows Program are no longer available, and we will not be able to offer you the Presidential Fellows Scholarship.
UT Tyler offered Ruxian its Patriot Scholarship because of his excellent academic record, but it was not nearly as much as the Presidential Fellows Program.
Ruxian says that he and his family were devastated by the news.
Yeah, I was making plans about going to U.S. I was also part of the honors program. I had been accepted to the honors program at UT Tyler. I received my I-20 and I was just going to face interview in the first week of May, a visa interview. And I had received the I-20 and everything, and I was fully prepared. And at the last moment, my scholarship got revoked, and it was very unexpected, and I feel very sad.
We asked Ruxian what he would do now. He said he plans to look at other countries than the United States to study, specifically South Korea or Canada.
But he said he might consider applying for graduate school studies here in the U.S. because other schools have offered to help his situation.
We reach out to UT Tyler for their reaction to this story. A university spokesman told VOA that they run into a perfect storm of too many applications, with students not applying for other schools and not enough money to award the full scholarships to everyone.
The university is honoring 184 presidential scholarships, including 30 for students from Nepal.
Ruxian Podel was one of dozens of Nepalese students who had their scholarships revoked.
Those affected by the decision have formed a Facebook group where they get advice from counselors from the U.S. State Department's Education USA website and from some folks in Singapore. They are also receiving counseling about studying in countries other than the United States.
We'd love to hear your comments on this story. You can leave them on our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
We're glad you're with us at VOA's Campus Connection.
Columbia University was founded in 1754 when it was known as King's College and was the fifth charter institution of higher learning in the United States.
Some of its well-known graduates include former presidents Barack Obama and Teddy Roosevelt, billionaire investor Warren Buffett, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, composers Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein, and founding father Alexander Hamilton.
VOA Mandarin Service reporter Chu Wu visited the Columbia campus in New York City and has this profile.
Columbia University sophomore student Ren Dongwu spent a year in volunteer programs before she applied to study in the United States. She had plenty of time to think about her future during that gap year. You've been in school for over a decade. You need some time to find yourself, to determine what you really like to do, and then go back to school for higher education. That's pretty necessary. Columbia University was her choice after much thought. She likes Columbia's values and cultures. Our school is very diverse. I mean, the students here. 52% is people of color. Well, white people probably is about 30%. To me, that is very important, because when we talk about education, it should be equal to everybody. Columbia University has a very long history as one of the revered Ivy League schools. Famous graduates include former President Obama. However, we probably are not familiar about Columbia's core curriculum design that has been a success for over 200 years. Ren Dongwu believes it is a key factor that makes this university one of the best in the world.
The reason why Ivy League is so distinguished is because of its core curriculum that has lasted for over 200 years. The core values have remained there, based on ancient Greek and Roman philosophies.
Columbia's core curriculum includes Western philosophy, classical literature, modern history, and others. All students are required to accomplish this curriculum within their first 2 years of study.
I have taken some courses of the core curriculum, and I'm currently taking some as well.
I think it's very crucial for constructing one's comprehensive values. Some schools may be able to train you to be a successful businessman or an elite in some popular industry, but not necessarily healthy values.
She further explains that the core curriculum helps students to become a better person instead of just graduating with the aim of landing high-paying jobs.
Study in a Western country is not just about skills, but about why we need to keep learning. Not only at Columbia University, most American universities educate their students to be a whole person and contribute back to the society.
The academic environment and profound history, together with the advantage of being located in New York City, allows Columbia University to constantly attract excellent students from all over the world. For VOA's Campus Connection, this is Chu Wu, VOA News.
You're listening to VOA's Campus Connection.
So, David, did you play any sports while you were in college?
No, I didn't. I covered sports at West Virginia, football, basketball, stuff like that, but I was never good enough to actually compete. What about you?
Oh, me neither. I'm very bad at balancing myself.
Well, that does help. Balance
absolutely
is a good thing.
In competitive sports.
Yeah, well, you know, competitive sports is a huge part of college life here in the United States.
Schools earn hundreds of millions of dollars each year from their athletic programs, and thousands of student athletes take part.
But how does that differ from other countries? Well, for some perspective, we talked with Tim Lee, a student at American University here in Washington, who is from China, and Nick Sobel, a University of Maryland senior who has worked in sports marketing and public affairs. Gentlemen, first of all, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Tim, let's start with you. You came from China, and your idea of sports culture from growing up there, when you got to the United States, you found things were very different, right?
Yes, exactly. When I first came here, I find out that everyone is so enthusiastic about sports. It doesn't matter which sports program, but in general, in every sports. And the thing is very different in China. So we have a system called nationwide system. It's like, while it comes to kids at a very young age, they can have a choice of either go pro or stay in regular school and receive regular education. And if they choose to go pro, it means they're working for the government and getting all the government support for training, for subsidies, and everything at a very young age. So the most beneficiaries of this nationwide system are kids from the poverty areas, because the country offers them a way to go on and compete and start a new career.
So basically, it's you are trained as an athlete when you're little, mm-hmm. and you either go pro or you become good enough to
compete.
Maybe go to a college
yeah.
and compete. Yeah. So, Nick, I know you work with the PR department with University of Maryland. So you must know, tell us a little bit about if you want to join a athletic team, how do you do that? How do you prepare for that?
You know, in the United States, I think the process starts at a young age as well. So that's definitely a parallel with China. But it's a little bit less structured. I would say, you know, let's take basketball, for example. So college basketball is arguably one of the biggest college sports in the United States. I would say after football or on the same level as football. So when you're young and you want to play basketball, you generally just play for fun until you're about 8 or 9 years old. You have things called recreational leagues, which I myself played in recreational leagues. It's basically a structured way for kids of all skill sets, all heights, all sizes, to just have fun and play basketball. And at an early age, you're basically taught to just have fun and enjoy and show respect to the people you're playing with. So once you're about 11, 12 years old, and you start to get to middle school, which is grade 6 through 8 here in the U.S., there's a bit of a fork in the road, I would say. If you have the skill set, and you know, typically these kids are, you know, probably 6 feet tall at least at this point, or around that area. They grow and they mature very quickly. They have the athletic body. They have the skill sets at an early age. So they tend to go to what we call travel teams. So travel teams are a step above recreational leagues in the U.S. It requires the parents of the kids to maybe be a little bit more invested to drive them to tournaments outside of the Washington area, for example, to places like Pennsylvania or Virginia or Delaware. And you're playing against a higher level of competition. So that's one of the more interesting things in the middle school ages. And then by the time you're in high school, I'd say players really have a choice. They can play for their local high school team, whether it be a public school or private school, or they can continue to play for their team, but at the same time play for what we call a travel team as well. And the league in this for basketball is called the AAU. So these players who really excel, and to kind of speed the story along, the process along, they really do well, and this is where scouts from universities come into play. There are high school tournaments all across the United States with, you know, thousands of different teams, different coaching staffs, and then that's what really draws all the eyes and the attention from these high-caliber college coaching staffs. So they will sit in at these tournaments. They may watch dozens of games all day and just sit up in the bleachers, take notes, and make scouting reports on players they like. And long story short, you know, through this whole scouting process, they may call the player to take a visit at the school, show them the, you know, state-of-the-art facilities at a Division I school. And before you know it, if they like each other and the athlete sees himself comfortable at getting an education at that school as well as playing for typically a Division I, which is the top division athletics program, then it's kind of a mutual agreement that you are going to come play for me and you'll get a scholarship, have a free education at the same time. So that's a little bit, you know, kind of a quick overview of the process. But it's a lengthy process, but I'd say it definitely starts at a bit of a later age than it might in China. And it certainly kind of has a different ending as well.
So do international students have a foot in this? Can they actually, you know, promote themselves and get into a team in an America football team or basketball team?
Absolutely. So it's funny you mention that because actually at the University of Maryland, we have a couple of international players. My freshman year, which is the first year of college, we had a player come all the way from Slovakia. And he was about 7'1" and a great player who, you know, obviously could dunk. He had the height to his advantage. But he was a really interesting player to watch. And this is a guy who came from Slovakia. I think he actually played in Spain at one point. But a lot of the best international college basketball players are going to be coming from places like Europe, you know, countries like Russia, Ukraine, and then all over Western Europe as well. A lot of these players end up playing in Spain. I think they have really good academies over there. But if a university in the U.S. has the money and the proper resources, they will generally send a scout over to Europe to kind of keep their eyes open for any talent over there. And I think that was a trend that we saw more in the late 1980s and 1990s, if you will, where people started to get the resources and understand that there was a whole mine of players that hadn't been tapped into in Europe. So there are absolutely opportunities, especially for sports like soccer and basketball, that really translate to these other cultures and countries as well.
Now, Tim, you mentioned something that kind of went by as you said it, but it's a very important fact. The process that Nick is talking about, you're paying for all that here in the United States. But you mentioned that in China, in the Chinese system, the government itself makes an investment in the athlete's performance.
Yep, exactly. So the government would support the young athlete, the kids athlete from a very young age. Take gymnastics as example. Those the kids will be selected like in the age of 5 or 6 years old. And those kids who competed in a higher level will be selected to like a state team or what we call like a province team in China. And then after the province team, the higher level competitors will be selected to the national wild team. And they will be they're the ones who compete in Olympics and all those international competitions. So it's like a pyramid. The higher the pyramid you're standing, the more support you're getting from the government, the better training facilities you're getting from the government.
So what's your opinion? What role does sports play where you are?
Let us know by posting your comments on our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
Thanks for being with us. You're listening to VOA's Campus Connection. Now, Lynn, what did you major in as an undergrad?
Well, undergrad, I major in diplomacy and international affairs.
And then you went to grad school at UC San Diego.
UC San Diego. Go Tritons.
Tritons.
For management, basically.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I majored in broadcast journalism. I started out actually as a theater and radio TV major, but then when I switched schools, they didn't have any, they didn't have the more technical stuff. They had broadcast journalism. So that's how I ended up here.
So was that, like, why would you choose the major? Is that a specific reason?
I had worked in radio when I was in high school, and the only way to keep working in radio was to get a broadcasting degree.
Absolutely.
And so the broadcasting arm was in the School of Journalism. Mm-hmm. So picking your major can be a major decision when you're in college. Some schools require it right off the bat. Others give you a couple of years to decide. To find out, we sent Nick Sobel and Zach Marcus to some local campuses here in Washington, D.C. to get some students' opinions on why they chose the field they're studying.
My name is Jeff. My major is information science. Information science is the combination of the technology and also information, technology, people, and also, what's that? Information. And information, technology, and people. Yeah, three of them. So now that we are in the world that are enabled by so many information technology, I really want to exploit the benefit of such technology to make a better life.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of VOA's Campus Connection.
We welcome your questions or comments. Post them to our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And we'd love to hear your stories about studying in the United States. You can let us know also by visiting our Facebook page.
Thanks to our guests this week, Dr. George Koop, Dr. Luis Profeta, Hafiz Lakhani, Lisa Schreider, Nikki Nance, and Rushen Podell.
Thanks also to our interns, Tim Lee, Nick Sobel, Sana Ali, Zach Marcus, and Yaelin Jung. A special thank you goes to VOA Education Editor Kathleen Strzok for her help on the Rushen Podell story.
Managing Editor of VOA Asia is Diane Gao.
Thanks also to our engineer, Tony Pollack. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
And I'm Lin Yang.
Join us again for another edition of VOA's Campus Connection.